Oh, hey, I'm glad you're here. Welcome to the first episode of VHS. I'm your host, Dirk Marshall, and this being the first episode, I thought I'd let you know a little bit about me. Now, I'm not a film critic, nor am I a film scholar. To be honest, I'm bad with basic facts like names, dates, and faces. I'm not doing this because I once worked at a video store, although I did. It was my first official job, but we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves there. In creating this program, I often described it as film adjacent, partly because that's how I grew up. I was raised in a mom-and-pop video store in a small town in Oregon. There, I would wander the aisles, enamored by the imaginative visuals on the boxes. I'd run down the rows and accidentally bump a box off the shelves, as I'm sure many of you did in your homes, only it was a picture of Aunt Judy, and in my case, it was a copy of Frank Henlonlotter's 1990 masterpiece, Frankenhooker. And yes, of course, I'd squeeze the box where the subway light was, on the front to hear it squeal, "Want a date?" I love that. Anyway, the rows were lined with all of my eccentric friends who loved to teach me about the world outside my small town. What's New York like? No problem. Sidney Lumet's A Dog Day's Afternoon and Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver had all my answers. And that also explains why I never went to New York City until 2008. When I was too sick for school, my father would put a blanket over a table, set me up with a travel TV down there, and a top-loading VCR, and I was able to pick whatever movie I wanted. I'd crawl out from under the table and put in Critters 2, The Main Course, directed by Mick Garris. The action, the comedy, the creature effects, they all left an indelible impression on me. It showed me, like, what imagination could do, what you could create. It opened my eyes to the idea that there were films that would speak to me, and others that maybe I would feel outside of. Sometimes someone might bring a film to you and you might not quite get it at first or understand it, and sometimes you just need time, so it doesn't mean that they're bad films or good films. Things just speak to us in different ways. Hopefully this program won't be about bad versus good, or accurate versus inaccurate. I'm not really interested in judging art in that way. But like most of us, eventually I moved away from home. I left the video store. And in doing so, I kind of forgot how special it was. I didn't really think about the childhood, the amazing experiences that I had for a long time. It wasn't until my engineer, because he remembered how I grew up, got me the book by Thomas Hodge called VHS Video Cover Art. And I opened the book and I had a visceral response. I had goosebumps. It was literally like I was returning home. All of the different video boxes there collected. It was amazing. And I knew that I wanted to talk about not just the experience of growing up in a video store, but sharing films with people the way that many of us, when we would see something we were affected by, would have to take it to someone else and be like, now you have to deal with this too. So that brought me to the idea of this program. But rather than interview people that made the films, we're going to talk with people that have jobs that are portrayed in the films or some sort of intangible thing. Some of the guests and combinations of films, I didn't really know why I wanted to talk to these people about this film, but then we discovered it as we had the conversation. So I hope you enjoy these conversations. They're aiming to be 50-50 on the film and a person's life and profession. Sometimes we might talk about the movie less. Sometimes we might talk about the job more. But either way, I guarantee there'll be interesting little nuggets along the way. So thank you for listening. I think I covered all this stuff. Oh, segue. That brings us to the first episode. The movie is The Stuff, the guest, an author and food historian, and this is VHS. Hello, and welcome to VHS. I'm your host, Dirk Marshall, and I'm joined in the studio by Heather Arndt Anderson, who is an award-winning author, a botanist, and a food historian. Thank you for being here.
Hi. Sorry. Got a little excited.
People can find out more about you from your website, voodooandsauce.com, and you are Heather Arndt Anderson on Instagram.
Yep.
If people want to follow along visually, that would be the place to find all of the dishes and things that you're doing. Mm-hmm. I know that you have done recipe testing and development for a number of businesses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cookbook authors.
And
creating recipes for a few small food businesses in town. Like Nikki USA.
Oh, yeah.
And The Oregon Raspberry and Blackberry Commission. I do some recipe development for them.
Other than cobblers?
Oh, much more. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I made a really delicious barbecue sauce that's good with like meatballs for your.
Oh my gosh!
Orders like the old-fashioned like crockpot meatball
yes.
style. Yeah, but with blackberry barbecue sauce
is
instead
there,
of grape jelly.
There's not mustard involved.
I think you could put a little mustard powder in it, but there's not like yellow mustard.
We were at someone's house one time and they were like, do you want a meatball? And I was like, oh, okay. And it was covered in grape jelly and mustard. That was
that's
the secret.
Absolutely wrong. What fresh hell is that?
I don't know where it came from, but it was like.
The 50s probably.
Yeah. And I've heard people talk about that recipe. They're just like, it's like magic. But I think yours sounds.
Magically maybe, disgusting.
Yes. Awful. Your books include Chili's, A Global History, Berries, A Global History, Breakfast, A History, and Portland, A Food Biography. Are there others that I missed?
No, but I'm proud to say that besides the fact that each of my book's titles have a colon in them.
Yes.
I have snuck a dick joke into each of my books.
Oh.
And they're academically, you know, they're published by academic publishers. And so this is like my greatest
feat. Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, you have to read carefully. But I have these little Easter eggs stashed in each of my books that all passed. Like they all got missed by editing.
Oh, wow. So in all the books?
Each of them, yes.
Oh, that's fantastic. And as a big fan of Portland, I have to ask if there was anything interesting you discovered when writing the Portland food biography book.
Yeah, I discovered a lot of interesting things. One of the sort of fun facts or little sound bites about Portland, or there's, I guess, two of them, but we have the oldest tofu company in America, which is Ota Tofu Company. And I'm happy to say that they, God, I think after being in the same family, the Ota family, for three or four generations, they just had to sell because Eileen Ota wanted to retire. She's the wife of the, I think, the grandson of the founder. And Ko Ota is like, he's super old. He's in his 80s and he's still working there. But they were able to sell it to a Japanese person who works in their factory. And so it's sort of staying in the family, which is really
that's
nice.
Great.
Yeah. And then the other one is that F.H. Steinbart's company is the oldest homebrew supply company in America. That's another of our little
We stumbled across that. I was, I think, buying something for my brother. He homebrews. And we just saw the sign and wandered in, and it was pretty vast, the amount of things that they have there. They were really friendly. We ended up getting stuff for him to make mead and maybe even wine. Mm. I don't know. There's all kinds of stuff going on in there. But
they opened during Prohibition.
What?
Yeah, so that people could make, quote-unquote, air quote, barley soda at home. And then if that barley soda should happen to ferment, oops, better luck next time, you know. So it was with a wink and a nod that they were able to sell brewing supplies during the launch of Prohibition.
I got to imagine the conversations were interesting with, like, police coming in and they're like, oh, no, we're just making barley soda.
It's like, do you remember going into a head shop in, like, the 1990s and, like, these are for tobacco.
Oh,
these
right.
pipes, these glass hand-blown pipes are for tobacco only.
Yeah.
So I imagine it was probably a little bit like that.
I think Sarah worked at, a head shop in Colorado, and I think they had to call them water pipes or something like that.
Yeah, the word bong could never be uttered. I worked in a hydroponics store. When I was in forestry school, so I was still studying like horticulture, basically. And we had to be super careful. And if people even came in, whoever even mentioned the word marijuana, we had to bounce them out of there because they were really strict.
That's so crazy. There was a place called Lazar's Bazaar in Eugene. Mm-hmm. I think it's still there. And he sold just like, you know, every poster you can imagine in the 90s and, you know, banners that have pot leaves and shirts and all kinds of weird garbage. And people would buy pipes there and like marijuana, like posters and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's like, what?
Yeah.
You know, it's so strange. But
free speech protects the use of a marijuana leaf on a black velvet blacklight poster.
Yeah, that's definitely what he sold. This is pre-Spencer's Gifts. So that's the type of place you had to go to buy those things.
I worked at Spencer's Gifts at Clackamas Town Center in high school. Yeah.
Whoa. What was that like?
It was actually pretty cool. I remember back then their colors were still like turquoise and purple, so you had to choose which color of like polo shirt you were going to wear to look professional while you're selling your fake vomit. Right. But there was like the little black light room in the back, which is where all like the stoners would hang out, and they would just play like the worst butt rock, like KNRK, like the real butt rocky channel. Yeah, so I started working there over the holidays in like 92. And
That's a great time to work there.
Yeah, it was pretty fun.
Oh, man.
I loved working at the mall. I worked at J.K. Gill's at Clackamas Town Center, too.
Oh, yeah.
It's a blast from the past.
J.K. Gill's is, what was that? Is that?
They started in, I think, like the early, like 1900, like the aughts, as a stationer and bookseller. And they continued, they were a publishing company, too.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so you can still find old books that were published by J.K. Gill Company in Portland. And yeah, so when I worked there, they were focused mostly on stationery and office supplies, like higher end, like linen paper for your business letters and cross pens.
Ooh. Nice.
You can edit all this out if you want. I know this is like deeply stimulating.
No, this is going to pivot into a J.K. Gill podcast, just exclusive.
All J.K. Gill all the time.
All of it. Yes.
I follow somebody on Instagram whose name's Jennifer Gill, and I always want to ask her, like, are you related to the Gills, the Portland Gills? But she, you know, is not from Portland. Oh. So, yeah.
Maybe she's related to Johnny Gill, which I think
is from Belle Biv.
Yeah.
No, wait, he was in New Edition.
New Edition,
then BBD, like, spun off.
Yes. Oh, man.
A little solo career, too, didn't he?
I think so.
Each of
I think I had a cassette.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what the hit was, but there was definitely some radio single where I was like, I'm going to get into Johnny Gill.
Yeah. Each of them went on to have very insubstantial careers.
Yeah.
Besides Except Bobby for, Brown.
Yeah. Oh, Bobby.
How far he's fallen.
Now, we're not brought together today to talk about J.K. Gill, but we're brought together by a film, and the film we're talking about today is The Stuff from 1985. The synopsis of the film is a private detective investigates a new consumer tasty treat that's absolutely delicious and just possibly lethal. What a great tagline. At the time of this recording, The Stuff can be rented at Movie Madness here in Portland or streamed on Kudu, iTunes, Amazon Prime, Shudder, but we recommend going to the video store, supporting them, browsing, holding movies in your hands, finding other like-minded people. And before we get too into the film, we're going to put it in perspective a little bit, some of the players involved. So the film is from 1985. It's directed by Larry Cohen. Some of the films he did were Black Caesar in 73, It's Alive in 74, God Told Me To in 76, It Lives Again, 1978, Q in 82, The Stuff in 85, It's Alive 3, Island of the Alive in 87, and A Return to Salem's Lot in 87. Larry Cohen is one of those directors that I can't think of growing up in my dad's video store without thinking of Larry Cohen movies. He's one of the directors that really had sort of a punk aesthetic to it, and then as I heard punk music and had friends that got into that stuff, I started to see these filmmakers who didn't care about laws and were just not getting things, you know, they wouldn't clear things. They would shoot people that didn't know they were in movies. I don't mean like shoot them with a gun.
Yeah.
And Larry Cohen was one of those people. There's a wonderful documentary called King Cohen, The Wild World of Filmmaker Larry Cohen, directed by Steve Mitchell, who co-wrote Chopping Mall. And it's a great documentary about him. Unfortunately, he passed away this year. The movie was also written by Larry. That's kind of how he liked to do most things. He was a writer first and a director second, so directing came as a way to protect what he was writing. And I think you can feel that in some of the even stranger films. It was cinematographer for the film is Paul Glickman. He did Perfect Strangers in 84, Special Effects in 84, and The Stuff in 85. The editor was Armand Leibowitz. He did Satan in High Heels in 1962, which I definitely have to see at some point. He did Full Moon High in 1981, Perfect Strangers in 84, Special Effects in 84, The Stuff in 85, Return to Salem's Lot in 87, and The Ambulance in 90. So he did most of his work with Larry Cohen, which is always great to see when people find their people and they keep bringing them back to make films. It stars Michael Moriarty, who's at 11 through the whole movie, mm-hmm. I think it's pretty safe to say. He did Q in 82, The Stuff in 85, Pale Rider in 85, Troll in 86, It's Alive 3, Island of the Alive in 87, A Return to Salem's Lot in 87, Dark Tower in 89, and a ton of other things. Again, he's a Larry Cohen player. He just keeps bringing him back. I think he would even write parts with people in mind, which is a great way to take all the stress out of trying to find someone to fit a part. We got Andrea Markovici. I'm sorry if I murdered that. She was in Space Hunter, Adventures in the Forbidden Zone in 83, The Stuff in 85, and a ton of TV. Pretty much every cop show through the 80s she was on. Then we have Garrett Morris, 1975 to 1980 on SNL. Car Wash in 76, The Stuff in 85, lots of TV and voiceover. Twin Falls, Idaho in 99, and even Ant-Man in 2015. Paul Sorvino did Cruising in 1980, The Stuff in 85, A Fine Mess in 86, Dick Tracy in 1990, Goodfellas in 1990, The Rocketeer in 91, Nixon in 95, and Romeo and Juliet in 96. And then lastly, we have Danny Aiello.
He hasn't had a huge role in this movie, man. But it's an important one.
It's so memorable. There's two things that we'll get to that I love about The Stuff, and one of them definitely involves Danny Aiello. And when he appears in this movie, I was like, Danny Aiello is in this movie? The Godfather Part II in 1974, Hide in Plain Sight in 80, Ford Apache the Bronx 81, Once Upon a Time in America in 84, The Stuff in 85, Purple Rose of Cairo in 85, The Pickup Artist in 87, Moonstruck in 87, Do the Right Thing in 89, Harlem Nights in 89, Jacob's Ladder in 1990, and The Professional in 1994. Those are just some of his credits. He's done so much work. It's pretty amazing. Do the Right Thing, definitely one of my favorites. Other people of note, Eric Bogosian is a supermarket clerk in this movie. And then Patrick Dempsey is an underground stuff buyer.
I don't remember seeing his face.
Yeah, I don't either. And I've seen it a number of times. Mira Sorvino is a factory worker and she's uncredited. So she did find a way.
She must have been like 17 when that film was made, right?
I must have been, yeah.
Maybe younger. She's not that old. She can't be more than like 10 years older than us.
Yeah, yeah.
Can she?
I don't know. That's the hard part.
She looks good, but isn't, yeah.
I was, for a different episode, I was talking about a film with Renee Zellweger, and I have no clue what age she is because
she's had some really questionable work done on her eyes and face.
What's happening.
She doesn't look. I don't know. She's no Tilda Swinton.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Who is?
I know.
Oh, man.
That's a pretty high bar.
I feel like the further I went back in, like, especially, like, foreign cinema, I kept seeing Tilda Swinton, and I'm like, she's just always existed.
Yeah. She's a vampire.
Yeah. She's got to be.
She hasn't aged. She bathes in the blood of virgins.
Well,
and
if you can afford to.
Yeah. That's the way to do it.
Yeah. She's probably the inspiration for that, the Jim Jarmusch vampire movie that he did. I don't know if you saw that one.
I don't remember.
I
love Jarmusch, but I don't remember seeing a vampire film.
Oh, God. I wish I knew the name now. I'm sure I'll get letters. But it, not a lot happens in it.
Mm-hmm.
But it, I mean,
but she exists.
She exists, and so it's worth watching just for that. So, talking about the film, things of note. The scene where the stuff goes up the wall was shot using the same rotating bedroom from Nightmare on Elm Street where Johnny Depp gets sucked into the bed.
So great.
It's so great. It's so strange and surreal, the parts of the film that have the stuff actually coming out of things. Mm-hmm. And in that scene, it shoots out of a pillowcase in a bed.
First of all, I think that you should do a side-by-side screen cap of that scene from both films.
Oh, yeah.
From The Stuff and
That's
from
a great
Night.
Idea.
Yeah, just to have, you know, for listeners to see on your website or whatever. Yeah, I don't know. What was it do? How did it get into the pillowcase?
Because after that happens, then a man runs in the room. So I imagine that stuffy, that man, was
the stuffy, that's right, the like derogatory term for the stuff addicts.
So crazy was that he was hiding it in
Of course.
He like went in there and was like, I'm gonna pour this stuff in the pillow and then in the bed.
Yeah, hide it between the mattresses.
I guess
that's what people did back then.
Yes, with stuff.
Hide
and
your stash.
The stuff. I think that's what is being, because when he runs in all angry, I think he's like, oh, my stuff didn't work or something, and then they tussle.
You know, it's funny. I, now that so much of the questionable material that we consume as just, you know, whatever consumers of media, it's all online now. And so is the mattress between the mattresses even a place where people hide stuff anymore? Like, do you remember when you were a kid and you'd like find your friend's dad's porn stash between the, like, in the
between
mattress?
Mattresses.
But people don't need that as a hiding space anymore, do they?
I feel like I'll be able to tell you in the next year or so with my daughter, because she just got her first journal / diary. She's using the word interchangeably, and she cannot write, but she has it, and she understands that she doesn't want people to read it.
Oh, that's good.
So she enters a room, if we have people over, holding it and telling everybody, you can't read my diary.
Your secret diary.
Don't read it. And then she proceeds to hide it somewhere.
That's really fun.
If it's, when we make her bed or change the sheets or whatever, I'll check and see if she's taken that. That's this is a good hiding place.
That's
right
really
now, it's, she's terrible at hiding it.
Yeah, I remember being really obsessed with the privacy of it too, but they had the little diaries that locked.
Yes.
That had the little lock on them. That was just so alluring.
Yeah.
I had a shitty little brother though too, so that being able to hide things and lock things was
important.
Really key, pardon the pun.
I was the little brother, and my brother was 5.5 years older. He wouldn't have cared at all if I had written anything of importance in a journal.
Mm-hmm.
But I had the one with the lock, and then it had a little latch right next to the lock that you could push in to open the lock in case you didn't have a key, which kind of negates the lock.
Yeah, exactly. It's just aesthetic.
So the film starts, and Larry wastes no time.
He jumps right into the action.
Right into it. There's a hole with stuff in it, and a man finds the hole, and he eats it.
At least he didn't stick his dick in it.
That's true.
He put his fingers in instead and then tastes it, which is almost as vulgar.
It is. It's pretty unrealistic, because I'm pretty sure if the guy saw the hole with the soft stuff in it, he would have just took his dick out.
You know, exactly. Yeah. If it wasn't a family film or whatever, that guy definitely would have fucked that stuff hole.
There's got to be an alternate version, or the first version Larry wrote, and he's like, and then he fucks the stuff.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, Larry, I don't think we're going to get backing.
What would the porn title be of that movie? Instead of the stuff?
I don't know. It could be the same, I guess. Just the whole rest of the movie is just a guy walking around explaining what's on his pants and encouraging the other guy. No, you got to go check out the stuff.
Oh, it's really... glad that we took that little detour.
I think we got the remake right there. The film also has an allusion to Chocolate Chip Charlie, who is the name of the character, but he's totally Famous Amos, which was, I don't know the history of cookies very well, but...
Famous Amos was a pretty...
It's a big one.
Yeah, pretty substantial brand. I think they still make cookies. They're like a Chips Ahoy. Chips of Ahoy. Chips Ahoy Irish instead of pirate or whatever. Chips Ahoy.
It also sounds regal. When you said it that way, I deserve that. These are the Chips of Ahoy.
If Nabisco's listening, call my people.
Was do you know if Famous Amos was before Miss Fields?
Mrs. Fields.
Oh, Mrs.
She's a married lady, Dirk.
Oh, is she married to Famous Amos? Did we just
break
something?
That's a very hot take. Mrs. Fields started, I think, in the 80s, because it was just a shopping mall thing, and she was person. Yeah. But I think that Famous Amos goes back much further.
And since we touched on malls already, and now we're talking about cookies in malls, I remember... when cookie stands, I don't know if they were chains, but they would actually bake cookies. They had ovens.
Mm-hmm.
And now you don't see that so much, I don't think. But I think even the pretzel stands, they're all made somewhere else. And then you see someone carry a bin to display them. Which I was for a while obsessed with Wetzel Pretzel's Twitter account.
Oh.
And then I just had to get off Twitter. Wonderful pretzel content.
They have little convection microwaves that do all that stuff, I think.
Right.
It's like an upgraded easy bake oven.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of the power of an incandescent light bulb to warm things, they use, I loved the smell of the food court so much.
There was the cookie place in Eugene, I forget what it was called, in the Valley River Mall, but they had a cookie that was chocolate with marshmallow in the center and frosting on top.
That sounds like diabetes.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's why I had cavities. But But yeah, I remember it was pretty fantastic. Next in the film, we're introduced to industrial spies. And so I wanted to ask you if industrial spies are real in food.
Yeah, and I can think of a specific example of that. Although this guy wasn't committing actual espionage. He's C.W. Post, Charles Post of Post Cereal Company. Oh, yeah. He did a tour of Kellogg's factory back in the 90s, if I recall correctly. Mm-hmm. He had his own health ailments, and so he stayed at the Battle Creek Sanitarium and did a tour of the factory, and then he ended up, I don't think that he had gone in with the intention of stealing secrets.
There's a movie about this.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah, The Road to Wellville.
Yeah, with Matthew Broderick.
Yeah, and Anthony Hopkins.
I think so.
Yeah, no, it's an outstanding, I think Bridget Fonda's in it.
Oh, yeah.
It's a really great film, but I don't think they cover Post in that one. That one's just focused on the like yogurt enemas and weird good living, clean living thing that Kellogg was into. But yeah, anyway, Post did see what was going on, mm-hmm. and how the cereal was made, and then launched his own company.
He was the spy.
He was, exactly. Maybe. I don't know. I can't make any claim about whether or not he'd gone in with the intention of starting a competitor, competitive business, but...
Well, we would know by
what
kind of coat he's wearing. Like, if it was a trench coat, then we would, it's clearly he meant to be a spy.
Yeah, exactly. With, like, the little pen that has a camera clipped to his pocket.
I don't know what size of the camera would have been back then, but...
They don't think they even had... Well, they definitely didn't have video cameras.
Right, he would have been like, I need you to stand still.
Right, for 30 minutes. Don't move.
Don't move. This is natural. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then there's the urban legend of recipes being stolen, and that's, I'm not sure where it started, but there was that you would ask for the recipe at one of the cookie places we've mentioned, and they would say it's $2.50, and you'd say, oh, great, and then they'd give you the recipe, but they'd charge you $250 instead of $2.50.
What a racket. How many children were like... devastated.
Oh, I mean, why did they have that much money to begin with?
Exactly. Like, it's just silly bullshit, obvious 80s? Kid makeup thing.
Yeah, but it's been attributed to Neiman Marcus, Miss Fields, Famous Amos.
I don't think that that's a real thing.
Right, and you can find stuff online, like whole letters that were supposedly written, but it's really
there's so many, like, children invent the most wonderful, outrageous. Do you remember, like, if you open your Tootsie Pop, if you find the Indian pointing the arrow at the star, that means you're supposed to get a free case of lollipops or a free lollipop. You, like, send it in.
Yeah.
And it's all bullshit.
It's not true.
No, none of that's true.
Oh, that's disappointing.
Yeah, but, you know, it's okay. That little thrill you get when you see the Indian, it's worth it.
Yeah.
It's worth any of those dashed hopes. Not free candy.
I think I kept those wrappers for a really long time, just thinking someday I'll know where to send these, and they'll just back the truck up, and it's going to be all Tootsies. In Portland, there was a kale chip situation at our old commercial kitchen space where there was a kale chip company, and then a couple of kitchens down, someone was making kale chips also, and... I will say, from a food waste perspective, and having seen that room where all of the garbage went, so many kale stems. I mean, I've seen an actual dumpster full of, I mean, it's crazy.
Just kale stems?
Kale stems and coconuts, because they were also doing something with coconut water. But anyway, one person went from one kale chip kitchen to the other kale chip kitchen and learned their drying secrets, and it was a huge thing in the kale chip world in Portland.
This world was shook.
Yeah, just in case I don't hear that's so Portland enough, we now had a
Can one-up you on that, because I won't name names because I don't want to, you know, get sued or anything.
Sure.
But I know one person, a former friend of mine, who worked for a bicycle tourism company in Portland for a while, stole a bunch of secrets. And, well, it's the tour information, like the script. She also stole some stuff from my book, my Portland book.
Oh.
Yeah, she said that she was using some of the material that the tourists and guests loved it. And I was like, stop fucking stealing my material.
Yeah.
I'm like, stop it. And she's like, but Emma, people will buy your books. Like, no, they fucking won't. So anyways, then she like left and started her own bike tour company. And at first everyone was trying to stay friends, but she just kept kind of showing up and hanging around and like, yeah. And then she poached some of their employees too.
Whoa.
Super shady.
Yeah.
That's just, so yeah, to, I think it might be on par with stealing Kale secrets.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. I mean, both of them ended up not being Kale chip companies anymore, but at the time it was pretty dire. I remember the intensity around the kitchens at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But since you mention it, and I don't know about this, how does it work exactly if someone was going to cite one of your books?
Well, you can cite...
like on a tour. I know in written you would cite
it. Well, I mean, yeah, I can't prevent somebody from saying words from my book out loud.
Right.
But it's plagiarism.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just that because of the ephemeral nature of spoken word, unless somebody's recording you, you know, saying the words, there's no way of being able to. And, you know, nobody else would necessarily corroborate it. These are just tourists.
But if they were doing the tour and they were like, Heather Arn Anderson's book, Portland, A Biography, says this about this statue.
Or
whatever.
Or yeah, you can say, well, you know, and I didn't accuse her of plagiarism.
Sure.
I just asked her to stop using my material.
Yeah. I just never thought about that before.
Yeah. I mean, people do get caught doing stuff like stealing other people's jokes, like comedians, you know, get called out for that.
I love it. Especially when there's YouTube videos that have side-by-sides.
Uh-huh.
I'll watch them every time.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm just like, that's exactly the
same joke. Yeah. So, I don't know.
I mean, so, some of it's people's in jokes. Some of it's people's minds just working the same way because we're...
I definitely
But there are
do
people that,
that jinx.
Straight up steal things.
Yeah.
I love to see it happen on Twitter amongst good people because then one of them just goes, oh, yeah, that's crazy that this happened at the same time and then concedes the joke to the other person or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives me hope in humanity.
Yeah. I think that's really the only move you have if you've been caught either cheating or accidentally having somebody else's idea.
Yeah.
It's all you can do is roll over and hand it to the other person.
Yeah. I mean... It's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Then they scream in the film, protect the formula.
Oh, yeah.
And the old protection of the formula. One of the things that's also exists on the internet and has been a huge topic of conversation in our home is this conversation of natural ingredients and how the FDA can protect people's recipes by you just say, well, it's a natural ingredient, so I don't have to claim this ingredient on my label.
Right.
So I wanted to take a moment to ask you a few of these.
Yeah.
See if you had any insight. And I'll start with the big one, beaver anal glands. So vanilla and blue raspberry flavors, do those exist in a beaver's anus?
Vanilla, yes. Blue raspberry, I don't believe so.
Okay.
Blue raspberry flavor, blue raspberry is a real type of raspberry.
It is?
Yeah, it's Rubus leucodermat. I mean, it's not truly blue. It just has this like kind of stomatal bloom on the, so it has this kind of like bluish cast.
Okay.
But it just tastes like a regular raspberry, and raspberry is like sort of famously in the flavoring industry, famously difficult to replicate.
Oh, okay.
And so the flavor compounds, the organic compounds that make the raspberry flavor are actually much more likely to have been derived from, cherries and bananas and pineapple. Those are the three kind of top flavor notes of chemicals that produce the flavor of raspberry. The tricky thing with blue raspberry is that because they had to switch the coloring agent because of toxicity of the red food coloring, they changed it to blue to distinguish it from cherries and strawberries. But the...
Wait, that's why blue raspberry exists?
Yeah, I wrote a whole story about it for Taste Magazine.
Whoa.
Yeah. The blue raspberry color imparts its own slight amount of flavor. It affects the pH when it's mixed with the other ingredients. And so blue raspberry does taste distinct, but only very subtly.
Yeah. I always thought it was just a cheap way to come up with a new fruit flavor for candy.
You remember how, like, when we were kids, I think red M&Ms disappeared from the market? Mm-hmm. Well, so it was a little bit before then. That was when they started really noticing some toxicity with the red.
Right.
Number five, I think it was. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they just make some switches. But the vanilla does come from the anal glands. You can get a imitation vanilla from beaver butt.
That's crazy. I used to really enjoy thinking about the scenarios where this was discovered. Mm-hmm. And my new favorite is that the person has been experimenting with the beaver anal glands and then travels to someone's home. And I like the scenario where the friend has made ice cream. And the friend says, hey, I made some homemade ice cream. Why don't you taste it and see what you think? And the person's like, well, they've never had ice cream because it's got to be really cold and food has to be scarce if someone's eating beaver butt. And then the person tries it and then has to be all polite when the person's like, what's it taste like? And then the person's just like, well, you know how there's two sides to a beaver? There's the front side with the face and the other side with the flat tail. It tastes like the undercarriage of a beaver. It just would be so shocking to the other person. But that's amazing that it has a flavor similar to vanilla.
Yeah.
Because the prices, if you were going to flavor something, vanilla bean, mm-hmm. way higher, I've got to guess, than a part of a beaver most people wouldn't even use.
I would assume it would be the other way around.
Really?
Yeah, because you can just grow vanilla orchids.
That's true.
But
so beaver anus is like the saffron of a beaver.
Yeah, it's exactly. You have to pluck this little one little bit, and you can't commercially raise beaver.
Right.
I don't think they need so much space.
You know?
So I would.
They need so much space.
They can, you know, they make ponds. I mean, they need a wide berth.
That's true.
I was thinking about this. It kind of brings us back to the stuff, though. Like, when we were, like, you know, laughing, and why would you stick your fingers in this and taste it? Somebody stuck their fingers in a beaver ass and tasted it.
Yeah.
And figured out.
The other scenario I thought of was when people were really trapping a lot of beaver.
Yeah,
and there's all the pelts and stuff.
Right.
And then somebody looked at a big pile of beaver anuses and was like, well, we should try it at least.
I was thinking, and ambergris was really big. It's still used as a scent.
What is that?
Ambergris comes from whales. It comes from some secretion from a whale's face, I think.
What?
So, yeah, bits of it can wash up on shore, but back when whales were being harpooned for oil, I imagine they, you know, it's a big animal, and I'm sure they wanted to use as much
of it
as they could.
I've never even heard the words whale and face put together before. I never even, because their eyes are on the opposite sides of the, I just didn't even think that they totally,
I mean,
everything has a face, but I just never heard someone say whale
comes
face.
From. Huh. Well, yeah, it's like a beaver.
Yeah.
You know, they're both mammals. They have a face and an undercarriage.
You know, yes, exactly. the next one is there straight black Chinese hair used as a thickener in quick rising dough and soy sauce?
I'm going to say absolutely false.
Okay, good, because that's pretty gross.
That sounds like some old anti-Chinese racist shit.
Yeah, there's also duck feathers was in the same thing as
that's
the hair, and I didn't know what.
More racist shit.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if somebody said cats and dogs, too,
you know,
just to add to the.
Oh, like, I got what you're saying. Yeah, that's the origin of the whole,
Like, it's unclean. That whole, like, Chinese unclean thing goes back to the 1850s.
Yeah, that whole, did you see that whole thing that unfolded with the L.A. restaurant? And
yeah, that bitch was. Well, I don't know how, like, I think that the shitstorm is what she had coming.
Yeah.
Hopefully she's shut the fuck down.
Yeah. I don't think it'll last long. Next is coal tar in yellow number 5. Yellow number 5 is commonly found in Doritos, Starburst, Mountain Dew, Kraft macaroni and cheese.
Yes. And it's used in other colorants as well.
Oh.
It was one of the, the color, a bunch of different dyes are derived from coal.
Whoa.
And coal tar. Yeah.
Why coal? I don't understand what the property is there.
I don't know. I mean, 100 years ago, it was a lot more plentiful than it is now.
Ah, sure.
And science had some leaps to make Coal tar, I think, and the reason why so many of the colorings that we were using back then became banned is because of their carcinogenic effects.
Coal being one of them. Mm. Although it's interesting that there was just a big resurgence of like coal ice cream or charcoal ice cream.
Charcoal's different because you can just burn
charcoal
wood
water.
Or bamboo and create charcoal. But coal, like the petroleum product, is it's different.
Sheep secretions in gum.
I could see lanolin being used as a waxy. Lanolin's used in lotion and shampoo and conditioner and stuff.
Do you know the amount of rodent hair that we're allowed to eat in food?
I don't know what the threshold is. But I think that if it's below like a percent, it doesn't have to be listed as an ingredient.
Yeah, because some of the things that I've read is like one rat hair per chocolate bar. But then I was like, that seems...
Yeah, I don't think they count it like that.
Right.
I think that if a rat is discovered in a batch of anything, they have to throw it out.
Right.
I don't think that the FDA person's like, well, nope, it's within the limits. You know,
this is a two rat hair chocolate bar. You got to get rid of it. Is rennet in cheese made from a goat's stomach?
It's from a cow's stomach.
Oh.
Because, I don't think that goats are not ruminants, so that... The word ungulate describes grazing animals like deer, goats, horses, but cows and bovids or bovines are ruminants. They have a rumen among their four stomachs, and rennet comes from one of the four stomachs, the lining. Yeah, it's an enzyme produced that allows cows to digest cellulose, and that has been capitalized on by the feed, you know, the beef industry, so they can really feed some, like, you could feed sawdust to a cow.
Wow.
And yeah, it's because they have the enzymes in their stomach that help them break down cellulose.
Okay, well, that concludes the section of weird things that I found on the internet, and brings us back to the movie, because the next part, a boy destroys the stuff displays in which are in a grocery store in multiple temperatures, and I was so baffled by this, because he's running through, he's so angry at the stuff, and he's shoving it off shelves in a cold section, and then he runs to just another stand.
End cap.
Yeah, and he's just like, screw this stuff too. And then I think that there's even another section, but is there something that you've ever seen in grocery stores that's kept in a cold section and like regular storage?
Yeah. You can think of like pickles and sauerkraut, and some of them are like boiling water bath or like canned.
Right.
Processed so that they're shelf stable versus the products like Bubby's and Vlasic. Do they make the cold ones too? Or somebody else? Clausen. Those ones have to stay cold because there's, you know, live cultures. They're still sealed jars though.
Right.
So I can think of those examples. I can think of tortillas.
Yeah, sometimes you do see tortillas in cold.
Yeah, the corn, you know, goes rancid pretty fast.
Yeah.
Processed cheese food products like Velveeta, they sell that on the shelf, but they sell American cheese in the refrigerator section.
Oh,
they're
both
processed cheese products.
Yeah, that stuff's not going to go bad.
Uh-uh. Do you guys put your ketchup in the fridge or do you leave it inside the cupboard?
Well, Sarah would not refrigerate any of those things. I am, for some reason, always put them in the fridge. I think because that's where I found them as a kid.
Yeah, my parents always refrigerated ketchup, but my mind was blown in high school by my friend Matt Hypes. Shouts to him. I was at his house and was like, what the fuck? We were all getting super stoned. I was like, why is your ketchup sitting? I was like, very livid. I was like, what the fuck? He's like, it does not say that it must be refrigerated on the label.
Yeah.
And I was just like, you know.
Yeah.
Mic dropped. I mean, I couldn't really contest. And yeah, ever since then, I was like, you know, nah, not going to put it in the fridge ever again.
Yeah. Well, at Denny's, they don't. They
it's
just
got
leave
so much
it out.
Sugar and vinegar in it. You don't have to.
Yeah. I was in a Denny's, I think, in the 90s. And I went to slop the bottom of the ketchup to get the ketchup to come out. And a half a purple crayon shot out.
Oh, God.
And
the bottle. Yeah. Glass bottle.
And so I was like, clearly a kid had put a crayon in the ketchup.
Or a teenager.
The waitress came over and I said, oh, there was, just so you know, there was half a crayon in this ketchup. And she goes, oh, well, we keep the crayons above the ketchup bottles. So in her world.
The ketchup like opened its little lid and a crayon jumped into the bottle.
Yeah. It was so, I just stared back in amazement that, like, that's the world she lives in.
She believes in magic.
And she probably drove there. I was worried, but it was amazing. Like, you could, yeah, that was, I think about it more times than I probably should.
I think that you should think about it all the time. Yeah. I would not be able to stop that.
Yeah, it's just, I just love that your perspective is so weird.
She's
that,
like, yeah.
Oh, I can make sense of
what
that.
What a magical world.
It's not that a kid did it. It's because we keep the crayons above the ketchup bottles.
Yeah.
And maybe if that's a continuing problem that you have an answer for it, maybe don't keep the crayons up there.
God. Yeah, exactly. How many people are getting ketchup with crayons in it? It's a recurring problem to them.
Yeah. So bizarre. She's probably like, well, those kind of decisions have to happen at a level above me.
Yes,
so
exactly.
I just can't.
That's one from management. Yeah. Corporate.
Our next team meeting. Which brings us to one of my favorite two scenes in the movie. It involves Danny Aiello, and the other participant is a dog. And in this scene, Danny Aiello is apparently, Michael Moriarty comes to see him, and Danny Aiello is so nervous. Man, is he nervous in this scene.
He's sweating bullets.
He's so sweaty. And there's a dog, and there's a part where we can see in the kitchen a ton of the stuff. And you're sort of doing the math in your head of like, oh, he's feeding the dog the stuff. The dog is...
Dog's a stuffy.
The dog's a stuffy. It's not just people. And the dog is calling the shots for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they go to the store together or if he's Amazon Priming it, but I mean, somehow they're getting all of this stuff. And after Michael Moriarty leaves, the dog has decided it doesn't need Danny Aiello anymore. Danny Aiello picks up a phone to call for help, and the dog goes over and unplugs the phone.
Yeah, yanks it out of the wall.
And then kills him. And it's just one of the best, like, there's no reason for the dog to unplug the phone. And it's just such a funny moment.
It's also a Doberman Pinscher, which is one of the trendy breeds back then.
That's true.
I think that was like a fun little time capsule, seeing this Doberman. The only people that I knew who had Dobermans were rich people or store owners or people who had something to protect, something to hide.
It's a formidable dog.
Yeah. I think like one of the guys that grew weed for my dad had one to like protect his stash. And this guy was kind of like, he drove a Cadillac, was kind of a high roller.
Right.
And then, yeah, the people, the store owners at the little mini mart on Milwaukee, just like a block north of Powell or Holgate.
Yeah.
That one, I think it's called like Brooklyn Market or something. Yeah, they had one because they'd been robbed.
Oh.
And so they had this like, yeah, it was kind of like the pistol of dog breeds.
Right. then they say there's something alive in yogurt, bread, there's something alive in all of it. Microorganisms move, Jason. They'll kill us all, the bad things that are inside us. It's interesting that he's now kind of moving from consumerism to this idea that we have all these things in us that are living and breathing.
I don't think anyone thinks that yogurt and yeast are going to kill us.
Yeah.
Also, you know, the yeasts are killed by baking. But yeah, probiotics are good for us. That guy needs to get on his Activia because he has got it very twisted.
That's so true.
Ask Jamie Lee Curtis what she thinks about it.
And on top of being an author and a botanist and a food historian, you also teach classes
about fermenting.
Mm-hmm. So you're the perfect person to talk to about this.
Well, you know, it's true that there are microorganisms all around us and in us. It's why, you know, the same bacteria that turn vegetables into pickles and turn milk into yogurt live on the human body. Lactobacillus, dig around in your belly button sometime and give it a sniff, your finger. And it smells like cheese. It's just because we have the same bacteria that grow on us. It just lives, they're on everything. That's why food ferments so easily. It's because the lactobacillus are all around us.
Wow. That is unnerving and fascinating at the same time, as I imagine most food history is.
Food history is, you know, is fascinating. Science is fascinating, obviously. But yeah, when you can combine food science and history and all of the little things that make humans tick with regard to what we eat, that's kind of what I like to study.
Yeah. And it's obvious with Larry Cohen that the film is based off of consumerism and, you know, ice cream or turning that into the demon rather than like a pleasurable treat. I feel like this movie could be updated by making it about Scooby from, is that right?
Scooby?
Scooby.
Oh.
Yeah, Scooby.
Sorry, you leave Scoob out of this.
My daughter, loves Scooby-Doo. So Scooby?
Scooby.
Scooby. And then we could just change the name to Kilbucha.
Kilbucha. Oh, that's really good.
The new one.
Yeah.
Another great thing that we both discovered in watching this film is Clara Peller is in this movie.
Yeah, she found the beef. She even got to use the catchphrase, yes. Which I'm really, well, I guess it's Larry, you know.
It's Larry.
Cohen can get away with anything.
Yeah. It still shocked me, though, when she says, "Where's the stuff?" I was he did it. He just straight up ripped that off. And then at the table with her, Abe Vigoda.
Abe Vigoda, who gets a shout out in a Beastie Boys song. You got to give snaps to those two.
Yeah.
They really made the film special.
They did. There's also wonderful commercials that happen in the film.
Yeah.
The stuff commercial in the beginning.
I love fake commercials.
It's really me too. The first time growing up that I really saw that was in RoboCop. Mm-hmm. And I was like, there's fake commercials in the movie? Like, mm-hmm. You can do anything in cinema. Like, I don't know why, but...
RoboCop. I still say bitches leave sometimes. Like when I'm like, just, you know, it's just
so
a great
good.
Room clearing.
It really is. Yeah. I love that movie. Then there's a wonderful broadcast at the end of the film with Paul Sorvino, and he delivers a speech and there's a mass recall and it saves the people because they're saved from the food that's bad for them. Have you ever heard of a giant mass recall in food?
Yeah, lots of times.
I mean, I guess the number five, the red
number
five.
Yeah, the dye, that's a pretty well-known one. E. coli is a recurring threat with greens. That happens all the time.
All the time.
Nuts.
We love sprouts in our house.
Sprouts,
and we can
you
never get
yourself.
Sprouts.
Yeah, you can get, like... If you want to spend like $8 on a little thing of them at Whole
totally
Foods,
done that.
Yeah, you can do it. I tried to grow them myself. I was like, God, if any hippie in the 70s could do it, so can I. But I've been very unsuccessful.
Yeah. No, we couldn't get anything.
Yeah. Listeria outbreaks cause food recalls. They're usually because of organisms, you know, people getting sick.
Beef is a constant one, I feel like, where it's like...
Yeah, I don't buy a lot of grocery store beef since, like I mentioned, one of my clients is a very high-end meat company in town.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So most of the meat that I eat is... I get in payment for my work. That's a fun fact about me is that I work for food sometimes, but I've cut that off now. Like, I don't... People who want to hire me, you have to pay me money now. Sorry, friends. I can only work for so many like noodles,
chest
flats
of
berries, and ground goat. So those are all examples of big food recalls that have been made. I think also when there's an accidental failure to disclose an allergen being in the same facility, that's another reason.
Or the cocaine Coca-Cola situation.
They didn't recall Coke because of that. Coca-Cola got in trouble, but it was only because they had failed to list it on the ingredients, I think. It exceeded the legal amount of cocaine.
Oh, too much cocaine.
Yeah, there was actually a legal limit for cocaine, and it was not zero.
That's amazing. I just had, Sarah got me something funny at the store last night. It was a Bud Light Orange.
So I don't understand.
It was an orange-flavored Bud Light.
Oh, wow.
And it tasted exactly like Orange Crush.
Ooh.
Yeah, so when you talk about like, you know, people are like, you can't have this flavored like this because kids will like it or whatever. I mean, kids will find what they're going to find. You know, I don't think it's crazy, but...
I gave my son a taste of my cider once, hard cider, and he liked it, but now he's nine, but he's kind of straight edge, and so he will ask now, like, does that have alcohol in it?
Mm.
And... Yeah, he just won't. It's like, but you're German. Like, you should have a little sip. He doesn't care. I can't peer pressure him into my little straight edge son.
Well, he's only nine, so there's hope for the future.
Just substance abuse in the future. Good.
Yeah.
I need to look for every parent's goal.
My daughter just had a tooth extraction.
Oh.
And so, you know, they have the what do they call it? I keep wanting to say euthanizing, but it's not it.
Anesthesia?
They won't do that. The anesthesia person came in and gave her the little drink and everything. And it was kind of fun to see your kid drunk for the first time because I was relieved that she's a happy drunk.
That's what I want.
Yeah, I didn't want the mean one. I wanted
to. Fuck you, Dad.
Yeah, exactly.
Just cutting remarks.
I want to fucking watch Scooby-Doo right now. Are there any common misconceptions about being a writer, an author?
I think there are probably many misconceptions.
Sure.
You know, that like little meme of like, what my friends think I do,
yes.
What my parents think I do. Yeah. I think that, I don't know if it's a misconception. A lot of writers do work in their pajamas,
mm-hmm.
but not all of us do. I don't, because of my schedule, I have to actually get dressed and do shit in the morning before I can
right.
sit down at my desk. It's not all, you know, it's very unglamorous. I think that the conception that we all struggle with self-doubt and imposter syndrome is very real.
Mm-hmm.
I've only felt like I was really crushing it like once or twice during the writing process, but usually I feel like this is everything's garbage,
right.
and that everyone's going to find out and like see how terrible I am. But I also write nonfiction, and so there's not that. It's a different kind of fear and self doubt. It's like that the real academics are going to see that I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about, and that they're all going to see that I'm total amateur. That so it's not that I'm not brilliant or that I'm not like creative enough. It's just that I'm like completely full of shit.
Right.
That's like a different. That's what nonfiction writers struggle with. I don't know, man. You know, before I started doing this, I didn't really have conceptions of what, I mean, we don't all like sit around
right.
smoking cigarettes and fucking each other and like being drunk on absinthe.
Mm-hmm.
Although that sounds pretty amazing.
It does sound awesome.
That's not what the life is like.
Mm.
We are all poor, pretty much. That's the truth.
my last favorite scene from the film is when Garrett Morris's head stretches when we discover that he's been ingesting the stuff.
Yeah.
And when I was a kid, that was the scene that made us all be like, you've got to watch the stuff.
Yeah.
It was nothing else that happened in the movie. It's just watching this guy's head stretch and then the stuff spray out everywhere.
That's what got the film an R rating, isn't it?
Yeah.
Probably. Yeah. Do you remember when that was like the pinnacle of horror?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I didn't let my kid watch the film because it was R-rated. And after I completed it, I was like, geez, this is, you know, like no scarier than watching Peter Gabriel's Sledgehammer video.
Seriously.
It's like such poor production value.
Yes.
It's just delicious. I mean, it's really, really funny.
Larry Cohen actually stiffed the special effects people half of the budget because he was so unhappy with what they delivered.
Oh. It looks like, yeah.
And it shows.
It looks like they got paid half of what they were promised.
What is a good day like for you as a writer?
You know, it's funny because as you and I are sitting down to talk about this, I feel like I haven't done any writing in a really long time because I've been doing my other jobs in the kitchen. A good day as a writer for me is when I have an idea for a story that I want to write or tell that hasn't been told yet. So as a historian or person who writes nonfiction, I have to find something that hasn't already been all over the other outlets that I'm pitching to.
Yeah.
So having an original idea or an angle that nobody has taken, feeling like funny, like my natural, because I feel like I'm a naturally kind of funny person.
Yeah.
I enjoy talking to people, being able to convey that, that part of my identity into my writing is really important, but sometimes it's just really difficult. So if I feel like I'm funny and my work is just kind of coming out fast, and that's when I feel like, I'm firing on all cylinders.
Awesome. And what's a bad day?
You know, I don't really have bad days. And you've asked me this before. And I think that when I get down to it, you know, even if I'm not actually typing words, I'm still reading interesting things on the internet. I'm still like dicking around in Google books, looking
sure.
at books from the 1800s, and just kind of like finding things out. I feel like I'm always just kind of learning stuff. And so sometimes I'm not actually getting anything written, but I'm still learning and I'm still doing some type of research. Even if you're just, you know, fucking around on Wikipedia and going down Wikipedia rabbit holes,
yeah,
that's still work. It's still research, yeah, and it's still valuable. So I try to cut myself some slack there. But yeah, I have a lot of like compassion for myself when it comes to, I have to, or I'd blow my brains out.
Yeah. Well, I guess you never really know what's going to find its way back into what you're doing.
Yeah.
And so we've reached the final question, and it's my favorite question. What are your dreams like?
Oh, man. It's funny because last night I had some pretty stressful, I woke up a lot last night. One of the dreams I had, I don't even remember the details. I just remember that like I was felt very stressed out when I woke up. I have the recurring stress dream of my chickens are laying dozens and dozens and dozens of eggs, and they're all piling up, and they're all breaking under the weight of each other. So like I go to try to collect them, and like they're falling apart, and half of them are broken.
Oh, no.
That's a really stressful dream that I know, like, I understand means that I'm feeling overwhelmed, which is a, you know, fairly common. If you're a freelancer, sometimes you just have to take on a shitload of work because you need to kind of keep things going, but sometimes it all kind of piles up together in one. So yeah, that's one of my recurring stress dreams. The other night I dreamt that a friend of mine from high school, who I consider to be a pretty successful person, that I saw him working at the cash register at the IKEA cafeteria. And I was like, whoa, what are you doing here? And he was like, oh, well, actually, I've got to take off now. So now you have to take over. And so I had to like run the cash register at IKEA, the cafeteria. That was a weird, oddly detailed dream. But yeah, mostly I think of the recurring dreams of, God, I almost forgot. I had a dream. I remembered the last time I spoke to you.
Yeah.
Dream should be the past.
Dreamed?
Dreamed. I dreamed that I was tossing Tim Oliphant's salad through some see-through panties. And that was amazing. I wish I could just freeze. I'm really glad that I'm remembering that right now, 'cause that was a very positive dream. he was really hot. And like his body was all greased up, and yeah, it was really, really sexy.
See-through, were they like Lycra or?
They were sheer panties.
Sheer.
Like, yeah, kind of like nylons.
Yeah.
But, and they were white. Yeah, white see-through panties.
Wow. That is fantastic. And what a great image to end on.
Yes. I want everyone to visualize just like eating Tim Oliphant's ass through some lacy white panties.
Now that's the stuff. Well, Heather, thank you for being here.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me, Dirk.
Thank you for watching this stuff.
That was great. And actually, I just wanted to give shouts to the Ready Whip that you gave me for my coffee.
Oh, yeah.
I know you didn't have any like marshmallow fluff or stuff for me to whiten my coffee.
I should have. I'm so ill-prepared. And thank you for listening to VHS. I'll see you next time when I talk about a different movie with a different person with a different perspective. Links to our guest and topics of the conversation are up on the website vh-us.com. Please share our episode with anyone who you think would be interested. Rate, review, and what have you on your preferred platforms. If you would like to follow along visually, our Instagram is vh.us. If you're going to be in Portland, Oregon, or you live in Portland, Oregon, and you would like to be a guest, then please put guest and your profession in the heading of the email. If you'd like to recommend a movie, then please put movie and the title in the heading. Thank you for listening. I'd also like to thank my engineer, JL, and my producer, Wade Allen, and of course, my amazing wife, Sarah Marshall. Until next time, I'm Dirk Marshall, and this has been VHS.